Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The fifth suicide bombing in Israel in the last 48 hours, now savaging hope for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Over the weekend, for the first time in 3 years, there'd been a summit. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon met with the new Palestinian Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas. But when the bombs started to go off, Sharon then postponed his trip this week to Washington to discuss the current peace plan, the so-called roadmap, which is supposed to lead, among other things, to Palestinian statehood in just 2 years. Joining us to discuss prospects for peace is Greg Meyer, a New York Times reporter based in Jerusalem. Welcome, Greg.
Hi, thanks. Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Greg, these bombings, what does it mean for the future of the roadmap for peace in the Middle East between Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, it's been extremely damaging. We're hearing now about another bombing here on Monday evening. It'll be the fifth bombing in less than 48 hours. This was the most ambitious effort to get peace talks going in almost over 2.5 years of violence, and it's running into great problems by groups that don't want to see the talks proceed.
If the terror continues, is there any chance that the roadmap can lead to meaningful negotiations, let alone a peace settlement between Israelis and Palestinians?
It's really hard to see how they're going to make any progress if the violence continues. Israel's position at the moment is that there needs to be a 100% effort on the part of the Palestinians to crack down on these violent groups. They're not insisting on absolute 100% results, but if they continue on with any kind of regularity, I just don't think we're going to see any progress. Done great damage to the hopes that were small but were there just a few days ago.
Now, is this a message, of course, to the Israelis and to the Americans and everyone else involved in the roadmap from Hamas, but also a message to the new Palestinian Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas?
I think so. The new Palestinian prime minister is in a very delicate position. He was not popularly elected. He was appointed and approved by the legislature. He doesn't have a large public following. So he's in a very dicey position. And if he wants to assert his authority and crack down on militant Palestinian groups, he wants to have something that he can show in return, an easing of Israeli restrictions, something that makes Palestinian life a little better. The Israelis say we can't pull our troops back or ease our military presence if we're going to be hit by a wave of bombings.
Greg, what's the significance of the Israeli government now declaring that it will not meet with anyone who meets with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat?
This is particularly relevant to the European diplomats who have been coming here and talking to Mr. Arafat. The Americans have effectively been boycotting him as well. The negotiations do proceed. It could complicate things. You have Europeans still going to Yasser Arafat and the Israelis then saying we won't deal with those Europeans. It would just complicate the diplomatic process.
Well, Greg, finally, is that, ironically, that willingness to endure almost a problem for the peace process, that people can get used to the situation, as incredible as the situation is, and that creates a lesser incentive to really make big sacrifices for peace?
Yeah, one of the things you've seen is tremendous suffering on both sides. I mean, the Israelis and the Palestinians have both endured large numbers of civilian deaths. Both their economies have suffered. You keep sensing or wondering if the level of pain and suffering is such that this will bring about a stop to the violence. And there seems to be a large number in the middle on both sides who would like to see that. But there are certainly extremists who don't want to see that, and I think is one of the problems that neither side has been able to get a grip on. And until that happens, I don't think we're going to see an end to the violence.
Greg Meyer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Greg Meyer of the New York Times joined us from Jerusalem.
Saudi Arabian authorities arrested a man with a gun outside the U.S. consulate in Dhahran today. U.S. officials said no one was hurt or threatened, but the consulate was closed as a precaution. The Saudi Interior Minister also says 4 people with links to last week's bombings in Riyadh have been arrested. Asked if the suspects have links to al-Qaeda, the minister said all indications point to that. Meanwhile, in Morocco, investigators are trying to find those involved in synchronized bombings in Casablanca that killed another 28 people last Friday. In both cases, investigators see or think they see the hand of al-Qaeda. Joining us on the line from Washington is Anthony Cordesman, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Anthony, what do you see?
Well, first, it's very difficult to know exactly who is to blame for these operations. We've seen three major sets of terrorist attacks, one in Saudi Arabia, where the evidence does strongly suggest it's al-Qaeda, another in Morocco, where it's possible, but a group that's not normally directly affiliated with al-Qaeda seems to have been involved. The Moroccans involved do not seem to have had training or ties to al-Qaeda. So they could be an affiliate group, but that's not clear. And then, of course, you have a separate set of terrorist acts in Israel, which are directed primarily against the peace process, and which seem to be the product of either Hamas or Islamic Jihad.
Well, let's stop you there for just a second, because there are reports that, in fact, staying with the Mideast, that Hamas now has ties to al-Qaeda.
Well, many of these groups have ties to each other, and unfortunately, some of the people that are fighting terrorism try to gain support by tying all of the groups together into one conspiracy, which often gives them more support in the international community. We need to be very careful about affiliation versus networks. The fact that terrorists talk to each other, they may exchange technical data or arms, and that they talk to various governments doesn't mean that somehow they are in control or centralized, or that every contact with the government means there's some sort of government link to direct terrorist acts.
One of the reasons it's suspected that Osama bin Laden was involved in the Moroccan bombings is that a month ago in an audio tape, he's reported to have referred to Morocco as an apostate and put it on a list of targeted countries. But if Osama bin Laden is removed from the picture, if the hierarchy of al-Qaeda is removed from the picture, does this kind of warfare stop?
No, it definitely does not. The extremist groups in Morocco have been a problem for decades. The Saudi problems with Islamist extremists date back several decades, and at least a decade before bin Laden. And virtually every country in this region has its problems with extremists, even countries like Libya, which are often seen as extremist in themselves. We really need to understand that whatever happens, if bin Laden and the leadership of al-Qaeda go, the group will mutate. If the entire structure collapses, new groups will emerge or old ones will be strengthened. So we're dealing with a continuing long-term problem. And we will have important victories along the way, but the only real way to deal with the problem is to be frank about it and say that we have to deal with this at least until economic and social development in the Middle East can catch up, or we can deal with other regional problems like the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Anthony Cordesman, thank you.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Another place where al-Qaeda is alleged to be involved in terror is the Russian breakaway province of Chechnya. Two suicide bombs killed more than 70 people there last week, part of ongoing violence that has cost thousands of Chechen and Russian lives in the 3.5 years since the latest conflict began. Russian President Vladimir Putin vowed Friday to end the long-running war. In a speech widely viewed as a run-up to presidential elections that are due within a year, Putin also promised to press ahead with amnesty for Chechen rebels who lay down their arms, an amnesty that will also cover Russian troops guilty of human rights abuses in Chechnya. Fred Weir is a freelance journalist and a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us on the line from Moscow. Welcome, Fred.
Hi.
Fred, last week's bombings, they were big. Remind us what happened.
Well, on Monday, a huge truck bomb was detonated right inside a government compound in northern Chechnya, and it killed 60 people. And 2 days later, two women with waist belts of explosives infiltrated a religious festival, which was staged by the pro-Kremlin Unity Party, and one of them managed to explode her belt, killing, I think, 16 people, including herself. So these are really serious, dramatic incidents, but they simply punctuate the violence that seems to be ongoing pretty well every day in Chechnya.
What does the ongoing violence mean for President Putin?
Well, he himself launched the current war in 1999 as a way of settling the Chechen problem for good. And it brought him enormous popularity. And so settling the problem, which has not gone away and in many ways continues to aggravate, is really a central problem for his presidency.
Hmm. How deeply rooted is al-Qaeda in Chechnya?
Well, no one, including Russian security forces, claimed that international terrorists had anything to do with Chechnya declaring its independence 12 years ago, or in the nationalist uprising that ended with Chechens throwing the Russians out in 1996, in the first war. What the Russians claim is that since then, international terrorists from the Middle East, from al-Qaeda, have infiltrated Chechnya and turned it into a kind of a launching pad. And there's some evidence to back up those claims. But there's a great deal more debate over whether they are the source of the ongoing conflict.
How have the Russians behaved in Chechnya?
There is no doubt that massive human rights abuses by Russian forces are well documented. There are a lot of human rights groups that have done studies on the ground in Chechnya and found mass abductions by Russian forces during security sweeps of all young Chechens that they encounter, on Chechen males, rapes by Russian forces, looting of towns and villages. And recently, there has emerged evidence that the Russians are also operating death squads that come and seize selected people, often not rebels at all, but potential Chechen political oppositionists, and they simply disappear into the night and fog.
Would you say that the U.S. government gives the Russians something of a buy on their behavior in Chechnya because the Russians allege that they're fighting al-Qaeda, that they're part of the war against terror?
There's no doubt that since September 11th, the U.S. and other Western countries as well have eased up on their criticism of Russia. Part of this may be simply convenience, because Russia is now a partner in that global anti-terrorist struggle. And if you remember back to the war against Afghanistan just over a year ago, Russia was also needed to help provide bases in Central Asia for the Americans. There were a lot of practical reasons. And it may be also that this argument, which the Russians are certainly pressing, that theirs is a branch of the global struggle against terrorism, this may also be convincing some people.
Fred Weir, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Fred Weir is a Moscow-based correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. To read his latest report, visit our website, here-now.org.
Just ahead, traveling to Chechnya and all along the Silk Road to tell the stories of people living through deadly wars. There's more coming up here and now.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive solutions, celebrating 20 years in the business, cmndesign.com. And the Boston Bean Coffee Company, purveyors of fine coffee, equipment, and service to the workplace, and exclusive distributor of Pete's Coffee and Teas. Information at 1-800-448-BREW. 78 degrees and sunny right now in Boston. This is WBUR.
Something new is coming to WBUR this June. It's the first annual WBUR online auction, and you can help make it a success. If you have an item or service you would like to donate to the auction, please let us know. We'll thank you by providing your company or organization with exposure on the air and on our website. To make a donation, call 800-909-9287 or log on to WBUR.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Nowadays, news headlines often reference places that were previously only familiar to many Americans from fading National Geographic magazines. Kandahar, Turkmenistan, Chechnya. In a new series of documentaries, filmmaker Taryn Davies travels to the Russian Caucasus and to Afghanistan and Tajikistan all along the Silk Road, and along the way chronicles the cultures that most Westerners can only hope to read about.
When are you going to be getting married?
Следующую пятницу. 4 апреля. Ой.
Next Friday?
Yeah.
Are you looking forward to it?
Вы ждете этого момента?
Are you scared?
Да.
Нет, нет.
Taryn Davies' films air on the Sundance Channel starting tonight as part of a series called Portraits of Islam. He's right now in the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome, Taryn.
Thank you very much.
Well, your resume is pretty incredible. You were born in New York, raised in London, went to Harvard, and then made your first film as you were taking an expedition, a horseback expedition, around Siberia's Lake Baikal. Am I saying that right? Baikal?
Yeah, it's Lake Baikal.
Which, you know, right there, you're off to a fast start. And then another film called Afghan Stories started right at 9/11. It begins in New York City in the days just after the towers collapse. How did you go from the events of 9/11 immediately to Afghanistan?
Well, having had this sort of great interest develop in this part of the world and traveled extensively in the former Soviet Union and in Asia, when 9/11 happened and I live and work just a few blocks away from the World Trade Center, and I wanted to get there to show who the Afghan people were. In fact, at the time that I went, there was one documentary that was an expose of the Taliban that really presents the Afghans as sort of terrorists and Islamic fundamentalists, and it was being played repeatedly on television. I wanted to go and show the other side, the ordinary Afghan people, and that's what I felt. That's how I felt I could contribute.
But in fact, before you went, you met a former pilot for Afghan Airways who told you not to go. He'd lived under the Taliban. He was arrested, and he tells you his account. Let's listen.
They're sitting on the chairs and enjoying themselves, having coffee, tea. They said, what is he? What is it? They said, he's a pilot. Oh, well, a pilot needs a plane. Let's get a plane for him. It was 10 o'clock at night. They're joking. So they brought a rod, they put it through here, through my back, through here. So now I can't move my hands, right? Right? And then they said, okay, this is an airplane. We got a pilot, we got an airplane. But airplane makes noise, right? He tells the other guy. He says, oh, yes. Well, let's start the engine. And now they come with that cable and they start beating and they start kicking.
The greatest privilege and joy and meaning for me is going to try and document these stories. When I meet with these people who really have never had anyone come and write down their story or present their story, I think it's a very cathartic, meaningful moment for them in the sense that they can share how they've lived and the horrors they've lived through and maybe give their lives some meaning outside of just themselves.
The third film that you're going to be presenting is called Mountain Men and Holy Wars. It tells the story of the Russian struggle between Islamic separatists in Chechnya and Dagestan and, of course, Russian leaders. You go to the Caucasus, and in a scene that we want to listen to, it seems like you're getting a little nervous.
The goal of the film here is to explore the roots of what seems to everybody to me the most complex conflict possibly in history, that between Russia and Chechnya. At the time that we're going there, this was in 1999, kidnapping was reported in the press as sort of the fastest growing industry in Chechnya. And so we were a little concerned about going in.
Your translator, Ilya, in particular. Let's listen.
I don't want to sleep this night. If you want to sleep, good night. I am not sleeping this night. This is not New York. Chechens kidnapping everybody over here. Why I'm a little bit nervous, Nicholas? I want to see you tomorrow.
Taran, in your Chechen film, you use a phrase, you speak of abreks. What is that?
An abrek is a sort of ancient Chechen tradition where an individual becomes, let's say, an abrek, and in doing so renounces all moral and social accountability to wreak vengeance on someone who has done bad to them. And so this gets to the heart of what the blood vendetta is about. And my film, in part, is about two individuals in the past and in the present, who some might describe as abreks, who have really led the war against Russia for Chechen independence or to set up an independent Islamic state in the Caucasus.
In your speaking to people in Chechnya, have you come to understand something that we talk about quite often that we just don't understand? Why is it that a people's hold a grudge for generations?
Well, this strikes at the real reality of the situation that when we talk about holding a grudge and how these people hold a grudge, what you've got to remember is that when the Chechens sought their independence in 1994, since that time, 15% of their population have been killed. The Chechens, ever since their original conquest in 1859, have rebelled against Russian rule more times than any other ethnic group, period. So I think it's because they're so conscious of their want for independence and freedom that this conflict, it's not about bearing a grudge for a long period of time. It's something that's never gone away, and their story has not been heard, and it needs to be heard.
Taran, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Taran Davies, director of three of the documentaries being shown as part of a series on the Sundance Channel this week. It's called Portraits of Islam.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, frightening warnings and hopeful treatments for smokers suffering from pulmonary disease.
And a treat for Beatles fans, the lost songs of Lennon and McCartney. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by UR listeners and by Partners Healthcare. Pleased to support the Massachusetts Prostate Cancer Coalition and its May 21st statewide conference for survivors, their families, and caregivers. By Creative Catering in Somerville, providing distinctive food for any event, catering menus available at 617-666-4366. And by Afinia Dumont, an executive fitness suite hotel in New York, where healthy meets high tech. Information at afinia.com. That's AFFINIA.com. Come explore the countryside and distinctive cuisine of Tuscany and Umbria with Silvia Poggioli on our next Citizens of the World tour this summer. Proceeds help pay for the news. For information, call 800-909-9287. Later this hour in Here and Now, a discussion with jazz critic James Isaacs about the upcoming release of Miles Davis, Live at the Black Hawk. This is WBUR.
This is Bob Oakes. What do you get when you make a contribution to WBUR? Balanced coverage you can rely on, pride in supporting public radio, and maybe a new car. For a limited time, WBUR would like to say thank you for your contribution for the news by entering your name in a drawing to win a brand new 2003 Subaru Baja, courtesy Cityside Subaru of Arlington. See the Subaru Baja and enter the drawing today at our website, WBUR.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, our D.C. roundtable considers the resignation of White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer.
It reminds me of a story involving the death of a Russian foreign minister. An ambassador said, "I wonder what he meant by that."
And jazz critic James Isaacs can't contain his excitement about the release of Miles Davis in person Friday and Saturday night at the Black Hawk.
Just in terms of the sheer excellence of his playing, not many of his albums surpass it. You know, he's just in rare form on these two nights. He sounds as if he is really stoked.
Stories coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Another blow against peace in the Middle East. Five people, including a suicide bomber, are now reported dead in today's attack on a shopping mall in northern Israel. Associated Press correspondent Mark Levy is there.
A suicide bomber blew himself up at the entrance to a mall in northern Israel in the city of Afula. There are dozens of casualties, according to the police. This is the fifth Palestinian suicide bombing in the space of 2 days, apparently an attempt to derail U.S.-led peace efforts in the Middle East and also the new Palestinian government of Mahmoud Abbas, who has said he will work against the militants to try to stop the attacks.
The AP's Mark Levy. The Islamic militant group Hamas has claimed responsibility for four other bombings over the weekend that killed around a dozen people. In the wake of recent suicide attacks in Morocco and Saudi Arabia, the president of the Philippines is joining President Bush in calling for a stronger effort against terrorism.
The Philippines and the United States are strong allies in the war on terror. The murder of citizens from both our countries last week in Saudi Arabia reminds us that this war is far from over.
President Gloria Arroyo is visiting the White House today, saying the war against terrorism should start with a war against poverty. Arroyo noted that there were victims from the Philippines in last Monday's attacks in Riyadh. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer is stepping down. The announcement comes just days after the president filed re-election papers. Fleischer says he wants to leave before the campaign gets underway and is planning to enter the private sector. White House aides say Fleischer could be replaced by his deputy, Scott McClellan. The Supreme Court announced today it would take up a case that could determine when states are allowed to fund religious education. This follows its landmark decision last year upholding school voucher programs. Treasury Secretary John Snow is urging Congress to increase the national debt limit. The House has already done so, but Snow says the Senate needs to follow suit. Otherwise, the government will not be able to cover expenses, including income tax refunds and Social Security checks. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is very far down, 164 points at 85.15. NASDAQ is following suit. It's down 31 points at 15.07. The S&P is off 20 at 9.24. It's 33 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Here and Now. It's 12:33. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Trader Joe's, a grocery store where shoppers will find a variety of foods and beverages, like artisan breads, heat-and-eat entrees, and a myriad of cheeses, TraderJoe's.com. The Flora Restaurant on Mass Ave in Arlington, featuring a new private dining room for business or pleasure, seasonal menus created by Chef Bob Sargent, on the web at FloraRestaurant.com. And by William Gallagher Associates, primary sponsor of Marketplace on WBUR, specializing in corporate governance issues and directors and officers insurance, WGAINS.com. In the forecast, sunny today, 80 degrees inland, a little cooler along the shoreline. Tonight, mostly clear. Look for 50 in town, 40 in the suburbs. Tomorrow, sunny in the 70s all over again. Right now, 79 degrees in Boston. And in sports, the Red Sox meet the Yankees in round one at Fenway Park. It's the first of a three-game series at Fenway Park. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Democrats on the presidential campaign trail are suddenly bringing up the president's record on national security, something seemingly unmentionable after September 11th and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, then criticizing the administration on military expeditions overseas and protecting the homeland could be painted as unpatriotic. But in the wake of the suicide bombings in Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Morocco, that's changed. Today, Washington is also abuzz about the unexpected resignation of White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. Joining us on the line now to talk about that and the politics of national security is David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Hi, David.
Hi.
And Jack Farrell, who's moved from the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau to lead the Denver Post's Washington Bureau. Hi, Jack.
Hey, how are you?
Jack, is the president vulnerable on national security issues?
He may be. It's a long way to the election, and we don't know what's going to happen between now and then. The war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq were billed as stepping stones along the way and never as the final solution, but people do expect results when the U.S. makes a big investment like that.
David, why are the Democrats out talking about all this all of a sudden?
Well, they're talking about that because al-Qaeda clearly is not gone, and it raises questions about security here at home. And right now there's no cost to asking those questions except the patriotism business. And that's not insignificant, and they may pay a price.
Hmm. Now, who's driving this among the nine Democratic contenders? Senator Bob Graham, of course, the former Intelligence Committee chairman, started the Democratic onslaught last week by saying the war in Iraq was a distraction and that the president dropped the ball on the larger war on terror. Is he driving this?
Well, I think he is driving this. He's the fellow who, number one, knows the most about this, and number two, talks the most about this. And the other candidates can't allow him to get too much out in front on an issue that may be, for all we know, by next year, the supreme issue.
Jack, your thoughts on that?
Senator Kerry, last summer, when the U.S. failed to pull the noose shut around Tora Bora in Afghanistan, began to talk out about how the administration might have blown it by letting bin Laden and his top lieutenants escape. So this is something that sort of rises and falls. The problem is for the Democrats is that every time they begin to get some traction on this, the president has the ability to announce a new initiative like the Iraq War, and it sort of takes a little gas out of talking about the past when we begin to focus again on the future.
You know, Jack and I have spent endless hours together talking about this issue, and we both come to the same conclusion, that ultimately the security of the American people isn't defined abroad but at home, that you're secure if you can go to the grocery store or the mall or take a bus without worrying about it. This is the ultimate political issue and the ultimate security issue, and I think in a presidential campaign you have to talk about the ultimate issue.
David, do you think Americans, when they see a big bombing in Saudi Arabia or Morocco, become more nervous about going to the shopping mall where they live?
Well, they say, number one, thank goodness it was there, and number two, I hope it's not going to be here next. And I think this is the thing that people worry about the most, and they worry about it constantly.
And that would be something they'd worry about in the White House, Americans feeling that way.
Yes, of course. They worry about how Americans feel, whether it's about the baseball race, or whether it's whether Red Sox are now tied for first, or whether it's economic security or national security.
You know, Jack, this weekend there was a union-sponsored forum attended by five of the nine Democrats running for president. Senator John Edwards of North Carolina said the administration hasn't given state and local governments enough emergency assistance money. That's an issue that comes up, but is it sort of too subtle for most voters to pick up on at this point or at any point, or will that resonate with voters?
I think at one point the issue of federal aid to the states and localities and what happens to your federal tax cut could emerge as an issue. I'm not so sure that unless the local volunteer fire departments are incredibly vocal, that the actual level of Homeland Security aid that gets to each locality could ever be a big political issue. The overall question, I think, of how well the Bush administration is working with the states and the cities, they've been taking a pounding recently in as strange places as Doonesbury, could I think, develop into an issue, particularly if there's continued layoffs, school closings, when we get back to school in the fall.
If there's continued terror overseas or, God forbid, here in this country, will that have an impact on candidates who supported the war in Iraq as opposed to those who didn't support the war in Iraq, David?
Well, I think it would have an impact on everybody because it would so substantially change the debate and the nature of the conversation. Each in his own place will be able to argue, yeah, see, I was right.
The other thing, too, is that it depends on what the scale of the attack is. Another major event like 9/11, and we're going to go back into rally around the flag for a considerable period of time before people feel the need or the ability to begin picking away at the administration and saying, how did this happen? Something like what you see in Israel or Casablanca or Saudi Arabia in the last week and a half is not so big a deal that would cause that sort of national patriotic reaction and could lead to some second-guessing about the White House and how they've handled this.
Well, let's shift our focus in the time we have left to a development just this morning in Washington. Ari Fleischer, David, resigning. What do you make of that?
Well, it reminds me of a story involving the death of a Russian foreign minister, and an ambassador said, I wonder what he meant by that. Well, reporters in Washington have a hard time believing much of what Mr. Fleischer had to say for the couple of years he was there, so maybe they don't fully believe that he's really going.
Jack, is this just a question of a gentleman with a good resume now going to make more money in the private sector?
Yes, I mean, the White House eats people up, the long hours and the pace and the pressure. unless there's something that we don't know. I think that the interesting question will be whether or not the White House decides that this amazingly tight-lipped White House has got to loosen up a little bit and give it to somebody who has a little bit better relations with the press. That would be a major change. But all signs are that they're just going to go with one of Fleischer's deputies who would maintain that sort of very closed administration stance.
David, he was not well-liked among the press corps. How come?
Well, he wasn't well-liked because he was kept so close to the White House line. White House reporters like it when a White House press secretary gets off message once in a while. And one thing we can say about Ari Fleischer, he was hardly ever off message.
Well, staying on message for us in the D.C. roundtable this week, two of our favorite journalists. Jack Farrell is Washington Bureau Chief and Assistant Managing Editor of the Denver Post. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
My pleasure.
And David Shribman's Executive Editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Still to come, a new box set of old live music by Miles Davis is released. Before you say, so what, you want to hear why jazz critic James Isaac says these 1961 club dates are something special.
You're listening to Here and Now. In the economy we all find ourselves smack in the middle of, what a difference a couple of years can make. Consider the likely outcome, for example, of going to business school just 2 years ago. An MBA then very much paved your way. In 2001, between 80 and 90% of business school students had a job by the time they graduated. This year, that percentage dropped to between 50 and 70%. The job market is tight, as Amanda Smith knows. She graduated with an MBA from the University of Connecticut yesterday and now heads straight for the economy's front lines. Amanda Smith now joins me on the line. Amanda, welcome.
Hi there.
Amanda, how tough is it out there to get a job even with an MBA?
I like to think that it's probably easier now that I have the MBA. We've been laughing here at UConn saying that, you know, thank God we're not Harvard Business School students because they're much more expensive than we are to hire. Certainly, we're in a different income bracket now, and we're competing for a different level of jobs.
Amanda, you had a job before you decided to go back to business school. How much were you making, and what were you doing?
Most recently, I was managing marketing operations for a line of software at Nortel Networks. I came to work at Nortel Networks via a company called Epicon, which was a dot-com that was acquired. We were a 40-person firm, and it was acquired for $220 million. We were, you know, one of the dot-com successes.
There must be a sense among some of the students that you kind of missed a golden age when a business degree meant a good job quick.
Gosh, we entered business school at a really unique time. The economy, when I made the decision to leave, was booming, and I was working in high tech. People told me that I was crazy to leave. I was making great money. I was young. The company was going places. Why would I ever want to go back and get an academic degree? Now that I'm trying to get back into high tech, people tell me that I'm crazy again. You know, why would I ever want to try to get back into that stagnating industry? So a lot of us, also in my class, came back to business school with a pocket full of cash. We have a bunch of successful dot-comers who went back to try to get their credentials. So it's kind of a unique time, I think. We've been living and breathing and sweating business. Now we're here and we can't get jobs.
Any anxiety for you?
It's not really hit yet. I've been going from 8 in the morning till 11 at night for the past 2 years. The momentum hasn't really slowed down yet. Most likely what will happen is I'll take a consulting job for the summer and just continue to on my job search while I do that.
If you met someone now who was in the situation you were in a couple of years ago, who had a good job at a good company but maybe was dreaming of doing a bit more and they were thinking of going to business school, what would your advice to them be?
Well, business school is a 2-year commitment, and, you know, let's all cross our fingers that the economy won't be in the state it is in now, 2 years from now. If it were another young person like me, female, who really just wanted to be able to take the next step in advancing her career, absolutely.
Well, it sounds like anyone who ends up hiring Amanda Smith will have made a good decision, and let's hope your decision to go to business school turns out to be all for the best. Good luck to you, Amanda.
Thank you very much, and I know it will be all for the best.
Amanda Smith graduated yesterday with an MBA from the University of Connecticut.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, also by Nextel, offering Nextel Direct Connect, the digital walkie-talkie feature in all Nextel phones that lets one get right through with the push of a button. Nextel, how business gets done. Nextel.com. And by Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, now accepting reservations for graduation celebrations at 617-720-5511 or online at lalaroqh.com. We invite you to meet NPR's Sylvia Poggioli. She'll be at a private brunch hosted by Tom Ashbrook on Sunday, June 1st. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 800-909-9287. That's 800-909-9287. In the forecast, a sunny spell for the next couple of days. Daytime temperatures generally in the 70s with cool, clear nights. 77 right now in Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Miles Davis. His longtime record label Columbia calls him the Picasso of jazz because of his ever-changing styles and lasting influence. And next month, Columbia is releasing a new Miles Davis CD, 12 years after his death. For fans, anything from Miles is an auspicious occasion, but Here Now jazz aficionado James Isaac says Miles Davis in person Friday and Saturday night at the Blackhawk is a cause for celebration. So, of course, we want to know why. Welcome, James Isaacs.
Hello, Robin Young.
What's the big deal?
Well, first of all, Robin, it's not a CD. It is four CDs, so that's a big deal in and of itself. You can buy this either as a four CD boxed set or as two CD sets. Depending upon one's budget, I reckon. So what's the big deal? First of all, to me, the big deal is, you know, it's Miles, and just about anything that Miles Davis affixes his name to is of importance in the world of improvisational music. But to be a bit more specific, Miles Davis seldom played better on record than he did on these two nights, April 21 and 22, 1961, live at the Blackhawk, the legendary Blackhawk in San Francisco. So ebullient. He is in such high spirits. You know, we think of Miles as an inner-directed player, an introvert, a moody.
You're being so kind. He often would turn his back on the audience and...
it's all show business. You know, it's like professional wrestling. Everyone has to have a shtick,
right.
You know, and that was his shtick.
But these two nights in 61, was he talking to the audience?
No. No. Uh-huh. Although, if you read Ralph J. Gleason's liner notes, and he was a friend of Miles Davis's, he writes that Miles, between sets, was signing autographs, was taking questions, however idiotic, from fans, and generally was behaving himself in an exemplary fashion.
And the music. Let's listen to a track from one. It's the Friday Night Show, and this is No Blues, Miles Davis. We'll be right back. You're snapping your fingers.
Oh, yeah.
He's up.
Yeah, especially with that rhythm section, which was his most locked-in rhythm section. The phrase that is used nowadays instead of locked-in is in the pocket. In other words, Wynton Kelly, Paul Chambers, Jimmy Cobb, piano, bass, drums, respectively, would find a groove and just lay on it. And they were absolutely masterful when it came to grooving and staying with it and accenting together. They'd kick together. They would go off in little...
I wish people could see you.
Well, you know, it just...
you're dancing in here to try to express
it. You know,
it
really bugs me that I was 13 years old at the time, and of course I didn't live in San Francisco. I was too young to get in to hear this stuff because, first of all, again from reading the liner notes, what do you think it cost to get into the club?
I can't even...
$1.
$1.
Yeah. $1 to see one of the great bands.
James, tell us about these concerts. Had they been released before? Did people know about them?
Okay. Originally, there were two single vinyl albums that came out, I'm guessing now, in late 61 or early 62. There was Miles Davis Live at the Black Hawk, Friday night and Saturday night. Now, though, for the first time, both sets on Friday and Saturday night have been released in chronological order, no edits.
Oh, I mean, it's like being there.
Yeah, so, I mean, the mistakes are in there, too, but to me that's as much an important part of the music as, shall we say, the non-mistakes.
How does Miles Davis make a mistake?
He'll blat a note, as they say. You know, you'll hear him going from one note to another, and there'll be a note in between those two that he didn't intend to hit. You know, playing the trumpet sometimes, it's not always so easy to finger the notes exactly.
Well, let's hear a little more of the music. Perhaps there will be a blat here.
or a squawk.
Or a squawk. What's a squawk?
You know, again, a misstated note.
Davis's version of If I Were a Bell from Guys and Dolls.
It's the famous harmon muted sound. Miles Davis would, when I say harmon mute, that's just the name of the company that made the mute that he placed in his horn.
You can see him holding it at the end of his horn.
So If I Were a Bell, I guess we could be talking just as easily about the bell of Miles Davis's trumpet.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, so many CDs from Miles Davis. Where does this set stack up?
Pretty high. I mean, obviously it's not of the same importance as Kind of Blue or Bitches Brew. But again, just in terms of the sheer excellence of his playing, not many of his albums surpass it. You know, he's just in rare form on these two nights. He sounds as if he is really stoked.
James, thank you for the sneak preview. And what should we leave on?
Let's go out on, again, another tune that Miles Davis helped make famous. Now, this is a movie song from a film called On Green Dolphin Street. Actually, I think it's just called Green Dolphin Street. And no one had played it before in jazz circles. Miles Davis recorded it initially in 1958, if memory serves. And after Miles Davis and his band recorded it, it was... You know, in the common language of jazz, everyone played On Green Dolphin Street, but not like Miles.
James, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Robin. See you soon.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. For more information on the soon-to-be-released Miles Davis in person Friday and Saturday night at the Blackhawk, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is WBUR, our support.